It's a pleasure for me, for In Motion, for all of us, to be involved in such a, I think, a wonderful and most important program. I also think it shows the importance and it's a beauty, the tremendous cross-representation of our community that we have, really from right to left and everything in between, up and down and inside out. It's really a pleasure that to see so many different types of people, and that's what the importance we needed, especially in our generation, the Achdut of the Jewish people. The Parsha this week, Bo, the upcoming Parsha, tells us, it begins, how God tells Moshe to go to Paro, and he should tell them that all the miracles I'm doing is leman shiti ototai ele bikurbo, leman tisaper bo aznei bincha. In order for the purpose, you should tell all the miracles unto your children. Parshat Bo is the Parsha of redemption of the Jewish people. It's the Parsha we left Egypt. And redemption is all about children. Redemption, the cornerstone of Jewish history, all of Jewish history is dependent on our relationship of our children, and that's how God begins his instructions unto Moshe. Parshat Bo, of course, is the Parsha of Pesach. Pesach, more than any other holiday, focuses on the children. And not surprisingly, the three of the four children who we know about at the Seder are alluded to, are mentioned in the Parsha. Because that's what Judaism is all about, the foundations of our nation, of Jewish nationhood, our children. And knowing that each child is different, and there are at least four different types of children. And of course, Moshe would not accept the offer of Pharaoh to go without the children. When Pharaoh says, you can leave Egypt, you know, all the adults can go and service God. And Moshe understood, you cannot build a nation with the adults alone. We today, as we all know, live extremely hectic lifestyles. I can tell you, just in planning of the conference, we were faced with a dilemma. If we want to be, you know, parents, how can we leave our children at 5 o'clock in the evening? And it's whenever we're going to do it, in itself, there's an inherent contradiction. We're very busy, and time is very precious. And we often are not cognizant, or it's not in our mind, that our primary role of parents is raising our children into God-fearing, ethical human beings. We are horim, we are the instructors of our children. We have to guide them in their path. And as we all know, the path today is much, much more difficult. The challenges we have not had before. And I hope that the conference that our three organizations are sponsoring can help a little bit, that we can all be improve our parenting skills, improve our work together, and we merit to raise healthy children in a physical, in a spiritual, and an emotional sense. And I hope that the evening will be a worthwhile one, not just for the evening, but we'll have a lot of practical benefits for a long, long time. Thank you. I want to introduce Frank Buchweiss from the OU, who really we have worked with, and the OU does this program in many communities, and it's been a pleasure working with him, and I want to introduce him to say a few words.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. For me, it's a great pleasure coming back to Toronto, because my first position was in Toronto, and this afternoon I had the pleasure of meeting some children who are now adults, who are part of the community. I don't know if you know Dr. Joe Greenberg, 619 Bathurst Street. I hear yes in the audience. But his children, David, Aaron, Amy, and Sarah, are now grown up, pillars of the community, very involved in the community, and it was a pleasure meeting them and seeing them again today. And tonight, one young lady came up who is the daughter-in-law of Harvey Shaw, and it was a pleasure meeting her. To me, Toronto always left many, many fond memories. And last night in Muncie, New York, we had a program on role modeling, a parenting program. Parents as role models for their children. And the second workshop was how to be socially successful. The key really is, as parents, children learn what they live, and they look at you. You are their chief role model. And don't think otherwise, whether they're youngsters or whether they are teenagers or adults. You have a profound, tremendous influence on your children. Tonight's program is possible through the combined efforts of Torah in Motion and Jewish Family Institute. Bronwyn Shepherd of JFI has been extremely helpful. Alana Kelman has been wonderful. Ariella Ebinger designed the brochure that we have today. Rabbi Kelman has been wonderful to work with, a pleasure to work with. And we hope that perhaps we will be able to do this again as a follow-up. The Orthodox Union, and you see the symbol here, it's a little different than the symbol that's on your Heinz ketchup or your kosher label. We all know that it's the foremost authority of kashrus. Here in Toronto, it's COR. Montreal is MK. Shows that I know my Canadian kashrus. But the OU is so far more than just being, keeping kosher. The Community and Synagogue Services Division, of which I am an integral part, really is one in which scholars and residents, speakers, are sent to various communities throughout the world. The parenting program, Positive Jewish Parenting, is an international program. Positive Jewish Marriages is another program. It's the same program as parenting, but with marriages. And the purpose of tonight's program is to present you with information to strengthen your skills, your abilities, and your knowledge as parents in working with your children. For those of you who have taken notes, I'd like to add one piece of information to the notes that you've already taken. And it's our website. And I welcome you to go to the website because you'll find all sorts of information. Information on Torah Insights, which is the weekly Torah portion. You could join the email list that we have. You could even join the Orthodox Union as an individual member if you'd like to. It's www.ou.org, www.ou.org. And there you can see all the programs that we have at the Orthodox Union, not only community services, many of you are familiar with NCSY, also Yachad, which is a program for the disabled, the Institute for Public Affairs, which is a public advocacy program. Ladies and gentlemen, was this a commercial for the Orthodox Union? You bet it was. Because we're proud of the variety of programs we have. The U in the OU really stands for you. And we would like to do whatever we can for Jews throughout the world, for you, for your families, and for everyone in Klal Yisrael. I thank you very much for inviting us here to join with you and to partner with you in this evening, which by all accounts and all information that has been given to me has really been extremely beneficial. Just a few administrative notes. Number one, in your goodie bag, just like when the kids go to a party, they get a goodie bag. So when you came, you received a goodie bag. So in your goodie bag, you had a pad of paper. After Rabbi Weinreb's presentation, we're going to have Q&A to our panel of presenters. Jerry Loeb, are you in the room? Not yet. When Jerry comes in, he's going to join us. He's from Chicago. Norman is from Long Island. And Rona is also from Long Island. Different parts of Long Island. They do talk to each other. And we would like you to take the opportunity for Q&A. We usually, if you'd like to remain anonymous, all you have to do is write your question, and Rabbi Kelman, myself, someone else will walk around and we'll collect your questions. We'll start off with questions that are written, and then we'll branch out to those who are brave enough to ask questions from the audience. So if you can, whether the questions, by the way, on Rabbi Weinreb's presentation or the presentations that you heard tonight, or any other issue of concern, please, tonight's a good night to ask those questions. All of the programs that I enumerated in my little blurb and my little commercial really are a result of leadership, and leadership of one individual who has really steered the ship, who has paved the way for everything that we do at the Orthodox Union, who has created an opportunity or many windows of opportunity for us to do. His biographical sketch is in the brochure. I'm not going to read it to you. I'm not going to review it with you, because whatever I would say would not do justice. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch Weinreb.
I too want to acknowledge and give Yasher Koach to Torah in Motion, to the Jewish Family Institute, to the various individuals who have been involved in organizing the conference and in conducting the various workshops. But I want to especially give a Yasher Koach to each and every one of you for attending tonight. You've sacrificed several hours of a Sunday evening, given up other things that may have been more pleasurable, and you've chosen to come here to learn a bit, and obviously there's still a lot more to learn, about parenting, about being a good parent, about being a better parent. And often when we do these conferences, we get a sense that we're probably preaching to the choir. The people who come to these conferences are probably the people who need at least who are already good parents but want to become yet better. We hope that you will take some of what you've learned tonight and spread it around, share it with others. One thing you've certainly learned tonight, and this is something we try to teach, is that parenting, like any other behavior, is learnable. No one is born a good parent. Parenting is something that you can learn. You can always improve your skills at it, but it's something which is learnable. And if it's learnable, there are people out there who have the ability to teach these skills. There are experts in the field, experts in mental health, in education, in psychology, in rabbinics, who each of whom have something to teach which each of us, all of us, can learn. I'd like to share with you my own notion, my own definition of Jewish parenting. There's parenting, and whether you're Jewish or a Hindu, there are things that we have in common as parents. But there's also something particular to being a Jewish parent. And when I say Jewish parent, I'm not distinguishing between an observant Jew, a non-observant Jew, left-wing, right-wing, Orthodox, non-Orthodox. The definition that I'm going to share with you tonight of Jewish parenting is across the board. So no matter what your perspective, your orientation, your background, your denomination, doesn't matter. I'm going to try to give a definition of parenting which will fit everyone. For me, parenting is a goal-oriented teaching process. That's my definition of parenting. It's goal-oriented because, like any important human undertaking, you have to have an objective. For some parents, the objective is to turn out people exactly like themselves. For some people, it's to turn out people exactly the opposite of themselves. But whether you know it or not, consciously or unconsciously, explicitly or implicitly, we all have as parents some notion of what we're trying to produce, what we're trying to produce, what the outcome is going to be. Sometimes that goal is unrealistic. Sometimes it undershoots the mark. But we all have in our minds some notion of what we would like this little baby, baby boy, baby girl, to turn out to be. And a lot of what we do is informed and educated and determined by this goal. And I think one thing that parents have to do, and they have to do it early on, is to make explicit with each other what their goals are in parenting, what they want their kids to be. I've done this with numerous groups. And I found out that what parents want their kids to be, when you really get down to it, is not the biggest genius in the world, not the most beautiful person in the world, not the biggest or best athlete in the world. What it all comes down to, people will say that after a little bit of discussion and thought, I want my kid to be a mensch. I want my kid to be motzei chein be'enei Elokim ba'odom. I want him to be good, as they say in Yiddish, zu Gott und zu Leit, to God and to other people. I want my kid to be a mensch. There's no word that says it better than the Yiddish word mensch, as it's used commonly even in, you can look in any standard English dictionary and the word mensch is in there. That's what we want. So that's a goal. To reach that goal, goal-oriented teaching process. Parents are teachers. The Hebrew word for parent is the same as the Hebrew word for teacher. Horim, morim, horim are parents, morim are teachers. The horos means to teach. A parent teaches. The Hebrew word, there is no Hebrew word parent. The Hebrew word is a teacher. Because the language, our language, our sacred language knows that that's what a parent is. A parent is a teacher. Truth to tell, every human being is a teacher. In all of our interactions, we teach. But certainly in parenting. And if you're a teacher, you've got to do it consciously. You've got to know, it's been stressed really in every workshop that I attended and all the remarks you heard tonight. You are a role model. You teach best by who you are. You don't teach by preaching. You don't teach by lecturing. You teach by example. There's a precious story. I worked for many years as a psychotherapist. And for a long time, I saw in treatment a boy from India whose parents were both physicists in the United States Space Program at the Goddard Space Center outside of Washington, D.C., which is where I practiced. This boy's name was Raghu, R-A-G-H-U, and he was a very, very religious member of the Vedanta religion from India. I treated him in various ways over many, many years. He suffered from a terrible degenerative nervous disease, something like cerebral palsy. And we struggled very, very much because of my Jewishness and his Vedantiness. It was a part of our relationship. I saw him from the time he was 8, on and off, until he was in his young 20s. He taught me a great deal. One of the concepts I shared with him was the concept of a hero and how important it is to have a hero. And I encouraged him to find heroes within his own culture. His heroes were not going to be athletes because this was a severely physically handicapped boy. His heroes were not going to be movie stars because I attended a wonderful session by Adrian Gold on body image. His body image was of a very ugly, misshapen person. So he didn't want to have glamorous movie stars as his hero. I spoke about my heroes, Rav Kook, Rav Meir Shapiro, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Chofetz Chaim. These heroes were not appropriate for him. Came from a very different culture. So I encouraged him to search in his own culture for heroes. And he came back once, the very first hero he came back with, he had a whole series of them over time, was Mahatma Gandhi. It's an appropriate hero for an Indian boy. I'll never forget the story he told me about Mahatma Gandhi. He told me there was once a boy like me with a disease, and his parents came and he mentioned the province in, let's say, in Western India. They came from this place and they wanted to see Mahatma Gandhi because they wanted him to help them raising this crippled boy. So they traveled all the way to wherever Mahatma Gandhi was, let's say on the eastern coast of India, hundreds of miles across the continent. It took them days and weeks and cost them money which they couldn't afford. And they came to Mahatma Gandhi. And they asked him for a number of things. And one of the things they asked him for was, our crippled boy needs a certain type of diet, just vegetables. But he loves sugar. He loves candy. Sugar. And it's not good for him. And we'd like you, the guru, to tell him not to eat candy, sugar. It's not healthy for him. The treatment then was a kind of a dietary nutrition treatment of this disease, and sugar was the worst thing for him. But he was a kid, and he couldn't resist it. So Mahatma Gandhi said, I can't do that. I can't tell him not to eat sugar. He said, what do you mean? We traveled across the entire continent. I took 2 weeks off of work. I spent all this money to get here. He says, come back in 2 weeks. And they said, 2 weeks? We can't afford a hotel for 2 weeks. We can't go all the way back and come back again. What are we to do? He said, I can't help him unless you come back in 2 weeks. So they did whatever they had to do. They stayed away for 2 weeks, and they came back 2 weeks later. And they came into the room, and Mahatma Gandhi put his hand on the boy and said, my child, I, the God figure, the Mahatma, I'm telling you no longer to eat candy, no longer to have sugar. Do you agree? Yes, I agree. The parents said, thank you so much, but why couldn't you do it 2 weeks ago? And Mahatma Gandhi said, because first, I had to stop eating candy. I had to stop eating sugar. He knew that he couldn't truly influence the boy by just telling him, do as I say, don't do as I do. He knew he first had to incorporate into his own being an abstinence from candy or sugar. And he knew, and if you know about Mahatma Gandhi, he was very, very self-aware. He knew that to incorporate that abstinence into his essence, he would have to refrain from sugar for 2 weeks. And then he could really say, I'm off, I'm out of it. And then he could bless or charge the boy with this assignment of not eating candy. It's a powerful story. And it tells it like it is. To be a good parent, you've got to be a good person. If you want to have a mensch as a child, you've got to be a mensch yourself. So it's goal-oriented, and it's teaching. And then it's a process. It doesn't happen instantly. No matter what pop psychology book you read, which tells you, try this technique, try that technique, that's not how it happens. It's a long process, and let me tell you something you might not like to hear. It is a lifelong process. One never stops being a parent. If you don't believe me, ask my mother. May she be well. My mother is Kanahara, approaching 90. Today's her birthday, January 9th. And she's still my mother. And when I called her from Toronto, and she's kind of getting a little weak in her memory, but she always asked me, where are you now? And I said, Ma, I'm in Toronto. So she said to me, Heshi, take care of yourself. You're working too hard. Okay. I have grandchildren, Baruch Hashem, of my own. I was telling some people around the dinner table. My oldest grandchild is a kala, a bride. She's getting married in a few weeks. So I'm getting on in stages of life. But I still have a mama, and she's still my mother, and that's how she acts toward me. And all my degrees and titles and accomplishments, it doesn't mean anything. I'm still her kid, and she's still my mother. Baruch Hashem. So it's a lifelong process. Javi and I, my wife and I, used to have on our refrigerator, and I wish we kept this cartoon, this poem, actually. It was a poem from a ladies' magazine, Ladies Home and Journal, or something like that. It was a poem in which a obviously middle-aged mother, late middle-aged mother, wrote this poem about how she can't believe what she's about to do because she's getting dressed to go to tea with her 30-ish-year-old daughter. She said, I can't believe after all I went through with that girl. All right? From preschool on, she was a brat. She didn't sleep at night. She was colicky. She wouldn't go to school. She was school phobic. And in school, I was always in the principal's office. And then she became a teenager. And she came home late. And once we had to send the police to find her. And she always was with the wrong crowd. And she had the wrong boyfriends. And she had the wrong girlfriends. And on and on. And we struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled. And now she called me up. Said, Ma, let's go to tea. When I came to tea, she was wearing a normal dress. And our hair was normal. And we sat and we talked woman to woman. And the poem ends, of course, hang in there long enough, it can happen to you. It's a process. It's a goal-oriented teaching process. That's parenting. Now, a few thoughts on Jewish parenting. Because parenting, like all other important behaviors, it's done from a Jewish perspective within a religious framework. If you're an accountant, our tradition teaches us you've got to be a Jewish accountant. Jewish accountant in the best sense of the word. Your business practices have to conform to all of the values, the Jewish values of honesty, integrity, etc. If you're a plumber, you've got to be a Jewish plumber, a plumber whose every act and behavior conforms to what it means to be a Jewish workman. Tikiya kapecha ki sochel, our tradition values good, hard physical labor. That's got to be your essence. If you're a parent, your parenting, your goal-oriented teaching process has got to be within the context of your Jewishness. And you've got to do that consciously. You've got to do that consciously. It takes reading, it takes study, it takes reflecting, discussion, workshops like these. But Jewish parenting is done within a Jewish religious framework. It must be conceived of as a sacred duty. It's a sacred duty. It's a mitzvah, no different from any other mitzvah, more important than most. I would say it's not only a mitzvah. The essence of our religion is being a parent. The essence of our religion is not being a rabbi. The essence of our religion is being a parent. There was a time when the Jewish people did not have teachers to teach their children because every set of parents could teach their children himself or herself. What Judaism is all about is a transmission of a faith from grandparent to parent, to child, and on down. That's what our religion is all about when you strip it to its barest essence. It's generation to generation, door to door. The major, most important Jewish institution is not the synagogue, it is the family. All the synagogues in the world could disappear and there would still be a Judaism, maybe even a better Judaism. But if every Jewish family would disappear, there would be no Judaism. The family is what educates, perpetuates our tradition. And this is true, has been true throughout Jewish history. This particular point in time, 21st century, early 21st century, the Jewish family is threatened in a way that has never been threatened before in Jewish history. The pressures of our contemporary society are such that they've infiltrated and have begun to undermine and erode the strength of the family. But being a parent is a sacred duty, which you can accomplish only with proper thoughtfulness, preparation, planning, and with siyata dishmaya, with prayer and with help from the Almighty. What are the goals? If the Jewish parenting is goal-oriented, besides the general goal of being a mensch, I'd like to share with you my framework for defining the goals of Jewish parenting. Number one, teaching a sense of self. A Jewish person has to know who he or she is. And that is begun in the development of a Jewish child when the Jewish child is given a name. Everyone here, I assume, has a Jewish name. Some of us may have forgotten it, may never have known it. When we were born, our parents or grandparents gave us all a Jewish name. Everyone here is a parent, who is a parent, has given a name to his child, his or her son or daughter. Why did you choose that name? Whom is this child named after? Or if you chose your own name, not naming after a person, why did you choose that name? This is true of all names of all human beings. But this is the beginning of shaping your child's identity. You have sent a message to the child that you have named, which will be with him for the rest of his or her life. And one must reflect, if you're an adult, why was I named, in my case, Tzvi Hirsch? And I was named for a great-grandfather whose name was Tzvi Hirsch. To this day, when I have special joyous occasions or special difficult crises in my life, I go to his grave. He's a man I never saw. I saw a picture of him, a man with a tall yarmulke and a long brownish-reddish beard with a full head of hair at age 75, which I didn't inherit. Or maybe that was just, airbrush. I learned something tonight, right? Maybe that was just airbrush. But I go to his grave because I feel somewhat of an affinity toward him. My sister, whose name is Esther, is named after a great-grandmother who was killed in the Holocaust, who was part of the 400,000 Jews, Tzvi Hirsch's and Esther's, who were put to death in the Belzec concentration camp. And that's a part of who she is and how she relates to her identity, how she relates to the Holocaust, which we all relate to one way or the other. I have a granddaughter, whom, Baruch Hashem, when she was born, all of her great-grandparents were alive. All of them. So there was no grandparent or great-grandparent to name her after. So they named her Aliza, which means joy. It means joy. And I used to take her every morning to Gan, to kindergarten, preschool, whatever. She was 3 or 4 years old. And that's what she knew. My name is Joy. And it's shaped, consciously shaped, who she is and who she thinks, what she thinks of herself. This is why the Talmud, by the way, is so condemning of calling people by nicknames. Because your nickname is not your identity. Your name, your given name, is your identity. The name you have, the name you give your children, begins, obviously, it's not all that there is to the identity. There's much more. But it becomes the core of one's identity. I learned this lesson from my favorite teacher, who taught me when I was a young boy, 18, 19. His name was Rav Shmuel David Rashavshik. I learned a great deal from him. But we came into his class as 17, 18-year-old American boys, and he was a refugee from Lithuania who came through Shanghai, et cetera, et cetera. So how does he relate to Pepsi, Duke, Rocky, all right? I had the mildest nickname, Heshi. As soon as we came into class, he went around the first day. I'll never forget this. This is a man with a long, at that point, a long black beard with a long black coat. He went around the room and asked us our names. And, of course, when Pepsi said, my name is Ephraim Fischel, so everyone snickered and said, ah, his name is Pepsi. And when Rocky said, my name is Avraham Elio, everyone laughed and said, his name is Rocky. And he said to us, you want to turn out to be fine, upstanding, Torah-abiding Jews, you can't walk around thinking of yourself as Rocky and Pepsi and Duke. You've got to be Ephraim Fischel, Avraham Eliyahu. I forgot Duke's. I only remember Duke as Duke. What can I do? But in that process, I'll never forget, he turned to me and said, Heshi, das ist nicht genommen, that's not a name for you. One day, it's Hashem, you're going to be either a professor or a rabbi. Interesting, I was 17, 18. Now, title I carry is rabbi, doctor. And he said, and how is it going to look like? And you're going to be a grandfather and a dignified person, and people are going to call you Heshi. You have to be known as Tzvi Hersh. Well, he said that R, like what should be said, Hersh, you know. It's interesting because today, Frank, what do you call me? Heshi, all right? People who know me from those days call me Heshi. But the person's name is extremely important. It's just, that's the core of one's identity. So that's part, what I'm talking to you about, is part of teaching your child a sense of self. Hopefully I've taught you just now a little bit about your own sense of self and Jewish self and connectedness to your Jewish name. Then, a sense of family. A child, a Jewish child especially, has to know that he has a home, physically and emotionally. He has a bias. He has a home to which the door is always open, to which the arms are always extended, where he will always be loved unconditionally. A home which is his sanctuary, her shelter, no matter what she does and where she strays. The importance of family. The importance of knowing, if you have three kids, two girls and a boy, was my family consolation growing up. The girls have to know you're Heshi's sister. And Heshi, you've got to know you're the oldest brother of Judy and Esther, and that's got to be there forever. And it's got to be there forever. Your brother and sister, and extended family too, grandfather, cousins, etc. It's all part of the Jewish experience. There's one Jewish word besides mensch and besides chutzpah that's in the word chutzpah, that's in the vocabulary of the average American, Jewish or non-Jewish, is mishpacha. Mishpacha. Everyone knows we're one mishpacha. The Jewish people are a mishpacha. The Jewish people are a family. You've got to teach that sense of family. A sense of comfort, acceptance, and belongingness. Mutual obligations and expectations. And you have to project the life of this family into the future. You're going to get married. You're going to have children. You're going to have grandchildren. I'm going to see nachas from you, etc. A projection into the future, a sense of family. Much more that can be said, but let me go on to three. Three is teaching a sense of Jewish identity. Teaching the child you're a Jew, you're part of an ancient people, you're part of a proud people, You should be proud of the fact that you're a Jew, and you have a kinship to every other Jew. This is for any Jew, practicing or non-practicing. The pride, the sense of being part of a larger people, a sense of being part of a people, of a peoplehood, it's extremely, extremely important, but it's more than important. It's basic to Jewish parenting. Establishing an attitude that one is a member of the Jewish people, and that that is a great privilege, which brings with it benefits and obligations. If you're a Jew, it's got to cost you. Financially, in terms of time, emotions, intellect, there are obligations, but there are also immeasurable benefits. There's a shared history and a shared destiny. And finally, if you're teaching a sense of self, sense of family, and a sense of Jewish identity, you have to teach your children, if you're a Jewish parent, a sense of spirituality. A sense that the material things of this world are not the most important things, that there are matters of the spirit which are more important. But from our theological perspective, to help the child develop a relationship with God. The Jewish people have, as a people, have a relationship with God, a covenantal relationship, a bris between the Jewish people and God. And every single human being, but certainly every single Jew, has a relationship with God. And here too, the relationship with God is a personal relationship. It doesn't have to be done through Torah study, although that's one way to have a relationship with God. It doesn't have to be done through doing various mitzvot, although that's another way to have a relationship with God. It doesn't have to be done through the siddur, through formal prayer, but it has to be done with a secure sense that I can turn to God anytime I want and have a relationship with him. I learned that from my great-grandmother, whom I was privileged to know until I was about 11 years old when she passed away. She was a woman really of the old country. But she was physically vibrant and alive until she was well into her 90s. And I remember when anything went wrong, whether it was finding out in 1945, 46, when I was 5 or 6 years old, that all of her family had been killed in Europe, or when the challah didn't rise properly, all right? Could range great catastrophe to minor problem. She would stop what she was doing, and I can close my eyes and picture it, and I consider myself to be very fortunate to have this. This is why I'm sharing it with you. She would stop what she was doing, turn her eyes heavenward, and say in Yiddish, Gott in Himmel, der Barem Dicke Tate in Himmel. Der Barem Dick means merciful. It's a Yiddish word. Merciful Father in Heaven. All right? Either, because I remember when she got the letter, it was written in Polish from a Pole about what happened to her family back in the shtetl. And she read it, and she turned to God and said, why did you do this to and named her brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews who had been killed? And when the challah didn't rise, which I seemed to happen more often than she would admit to, God in heaven, or more likely, Tata in Himmel, Father in heaven, help me out. What would she say in Yiddish? Help out a poor old lady. All right. Help me out. I want the challah. And when me and my cousin were standing by, she would say, I want to have delicious challah for Heshen you and for Matan you. All right, please help me out, because she was modeling for us. She had a relationship with God. That to me is, whenever I hear talk about spirituality, which is a big word these days, I think of my great-grandmother and that image. We can't all be as pious and as natural as my great-grandmother, but teaching one's children and teaching oneself a sense of spirituality, of relationship with God, is the fourth component of Jewish parenting. So we have these four components. Have the overall definition of parenting in general, goal-oriented, teaching process, and four goals for the Jewish parent: sense of self, sense of family, sense of Jewish identity and sense of spirituality. This is my talk for this evening. I thank you very, very much for listening. I look forward now to the question and answer session.
We now would like to ask all of you to please, if you have any questions, write your questions down, and we are going to be taking questions from the audience as well. Dr. Jerry Loeb from Chicago, Rabbi Weinreb will be the moderator of the Q&A, Dr. Blumenthal, and Dr. Novick. Would anybody like to begin with a question from the audience? Okay, we'll collect the sheets in a moment.
I want you to know that in my own practice, I try to collect these questions, the written form of the questions, because they often form the stuff out of which my thinking about contemporary Jewish families and their concerns are drawn. Remember that Frank explained earlier that we were having the written questions submitted, and as we get through them, if there are some brave souls who want to stand up and ask a question in person, that's fine too. Let's just begin. I don't want to delay this any longer. I'm just opening to the first question here. How can you teach your kids something you was underlined, haven't mastered yet? You want to stand up that one?
I've mastered this, I guess. I'm going to stand up, but we're kind of connected. Can you hear? I think that when we've heard so many times tonight that we are role models, it's helpful and important to remember that children learn best from imperfect models, not from superheroes. If you're a super parent and everything comes easy to you, children will dismiss you. They'll say, no, you know, Mom and Dad make it look so easy. I can't be like them. So that while it is wonderful if you've mastered everything and then can impart it to your child as superhero master teacher, it is perfectly fine to be a role model to your children as we take the journey together. And certainly one of the things that I've learned in my practice in working with many young children and adolescents is to help them understand that life's a process for all of us and that we're not perfect yet and we're not grown yet. We're still growing and we're still changing. And we're actually a very nice role model for our children when we say that. On the other hand, you cannot teach a child to do something when you are clearly doing the opposite. So you cannot say to your children, be spiritual, have values, when all you care about is making, having, owning, getting. So we do have to look at our own behavior, but we don't have to be perfect, and we can do it together with our children.
Thanks, Rona. I would also add, I'm not sure the kinds of things the questioner was talking about when he asked, or she asked, how can you teach your kids something you haven't mastered yet? But with certain kinds of learning, you can teach your kids by learning it together with the child. So that's something you haven't mastered yet because you have a limited Jewish education. Your child's in a Jewish school, and you haven't mastered studying Chumash and Rashi. And how do you teach it to your kid? Well, the best way to teach it is to say, okay, this is not father-son anymore, or mother-daughter, or father-daughter, whatever. This is the two of us studying b'chavrusa. We're studying together. And this is true with secular things as well. Jerry, Dr. Loeb.
Hi, I just wanted to add that I have a powerful memory from when my kids were younger, And we were trying to work on angry outbursts in the house, and I remember saying to, we have five sons, you know, it's too noisy in this house, there's too much yelling. And finally one of the kids said, yeah, there is too much yelling. And there was this sense of that it wasn't the kids only that were doing the yelling. So it turned a corner in our family when we said, okay. And we put a chart on the wall in a sense of, and include the adults. And the deal was that if you lost your temper, you yelled, you shouted, then you'd have to give some money to tzedakah, into the pushka, into the charity box. And for the adults, it would be a dollar each time, and for the children, it would be a nickel. And I made sure to kind of like yell, although the kids knew that it was planned. And our family changed as a result of that. So it was something, I agree with Rabbi Weintraub, it was something that we were working on together. It was the sense of, and the parents were modeling, but it was modeling the process. And as Rona said, that we're not perfect parents, and that's part of the process of what we teach our children as well.
Okay, the next question is, please address the conflict that can occur when, quote, normal adolescent development, end quote, issues conflict with mitzvah observance, i.e., one, interest in the opposite sex, two, individuation and some rebellion, three, need for extra sleep versus zaman tefillah, time for going to synagogue to pray. Save that one for you, Norm.
I recently heard someone ask a question about the famous Akedah when Abraham nearly sacrificed his son Isaac. As some of you may know, Isaac was 30 years old at the time. Someone once asked, why didn't God command Abraham to do it when Isaac was an adolescent? And the answer was, because it wouldn't have been a sacrifice. okay. Anyone, as I and my colleagues here who've worked with teens and teens who are rebelling, know that the key is to preserve the relationship. And sometimes you have to make a judgment call in terms of what you insist upon and what will possibly sacrifice the relationship. And I know that I have discussed this with you know, rabbinic figures, and all consistently agree that whereas the goal is ultimately to raise a child who's observant and has the type of spirituality that Rabbi Weintraub spoke about, if you get into these kind of power struggles and if you get caught up in details, that sometimes you kind of throw out the baby with the water. So the key thing is you certainly don't give up on an adolescent, you certainly don't give him a carte blanche or do whatever he wants, but you do everything possible to preserve the relationship in the process.
Okay. How do you teach children to respect siblings and have a good lifetime relationship when friends and other things always take precedence? In parentheses, I haven't mastered this either. Sign somebody? No volunteers. Again, the question was, how does one teach respect for siblings when the child is more interested in friends and other things? First of all, of course, it's normal and natural for a child of any age to prefer like-aged company rather than older siblings or younger siblings. So there's a great part of that that's natural and normal. And you don't want to take that away from the kid, this opportunity to grow and to learn from his or her peers. But the way to teach, respect for siblings, I'll give you a few ideas. Number one, to have time when the family spends time as a family. Whether it's a vacation, whether it's a common family meal, whether it's some family project. When the family just is just the family, nobody else, it's just pop and mom and the kids. That's extremely important. The other another way, which sounds kind of gimmicky, and when I first read about it, my kids were below 10, all of them. I thought it was a gimmick, but at that point they were so desperate that I said, I'll try anything to get these kids to get along with each other. Is that whenever our three kids, Gila, Shaul, and Miriam, whenever Gila didn't do something for her, or let's say she dropped an article of clothing on the floor, instead of saying, Gila, please pick that up, we would say, Shaul, why don't you pick up your sister's whatever? And then when Shaul would have his books in disarray, which he still does to this day, I would tell Gila, okay, you know, your brother did this for you, and why don't you help him with that? And this was, although the kids are, when one was 10, one was 7, the other was 3, this was something that worked across those ages within reason. It became kind of a game. I'll do your work for you, you do my work for me, and it's something that they look back to now with thinking that their father is this crazy shrink, which it wasn't so bad because it gained us a lot of Shalom bias. Again, I hate to, I must come back to the issue of modeling. If you don't get along well with your siblings, or don't get along at all with your siblings, then how can you expect your kids to do so? If your kids see that you and your sisters, brothers, whatever, to this day, although you're separated by hundreds of miles or several years of age or different ideologies or whatever, that you're in touch with each other, that you respect each other, that you go to each other's simchas, you're there for each other, and that's a lesson that they pick up very, very quickly. You know, kids will learn a lot about the way you treat their aunts and uncles, about the way they should behave with their brothers and sisters. Set of keys. Am I supposed to announce this? It's yours? No? Next question. How do you get a child to accept responsibility for his or her actions rather than blaming others for their actions? Responsibility versus blame, a big one. Rona is good at blame.
Yeah, I like it. Norm points to me to make her do it on the question on accepting responsibility. We work together too often, Norm. I think this is an area where you have to prime the pump and set the stage for success. And if you approach a child and say, is it true that you did such and such yesterday? And while they're shivering and shaking, they're going to say, no, not me, he did it. But if you start the conversation by saying, I'm going to ask you a tough question, and I can't promise you that I won't be upset with your answer, but I will be more upset if you're not honest with me. You can take the easy way out, but I want you to have courage here. Take a deep breath. Are you ready? I'm going to ask you now. Here comes the tough question. Who broke my favorite vase? So that's the way you set it up. But I think too often as parents, we run in Hawaii 5-0. Okay, book 'em. You know, who did this? I'm going to get you. And we can't, if we want kids to take responsibility, then we have to create an environment where in our families, we all come forward and take responsibility when we, when it's due.
Okay. I mentioned this is a big issue because to me this is not only a child-rearing issue, but this is one of the central issues of our time, blame versus responsibility. We live in a culture where people, politicians, leaders, medical professionals, etc., do not take responsibilities for their actions, but blame their upbringing, the machinery, or whatever else can be blamed. And it's certainly a big part of our religion that one must accept responsibility for one's misdeeds as well as for one's good deeds. Next question is a very good one. A little different, but still a very important part of Jewish parenting. The question is, it is important for our kids to have a strong Jewish identity, but how do we help them to deal with fears, the shorthand symbol here, I think it means with reference to anti-Semitism. Example, My daughter worries about wearing a Star of David in public. This is, unfortunately, a question that has become more relevant in the past several years with the increase of open anti-Semitism across the world. So that's a good question. I'll shirk responsibility and pass it on to whoever wants to take it.
I grew up in Brooklyn, and it wasn't always safe to walk through the streets of Brooklyn with a yarmulke on. So this kind of resonates with me. My parents were survivors as well, and the world didn't feel like a safe place. On the other hand, somehow the unspoken message in the family was that while it can be scary at times, there is a sense of pride of what it means to be a part of something bigger, to be a part of really a history and a destiny and something, even though things can be a little hairy at times. So while there were days that I felt like, do I need to do this yarmulke thing? There were much more days in which I said, this is part of who I was, and it was really a core of my identity. So I guess what I'm talking about is to create an atmosphere in the home where we do things that will be sometimes hard. Really, anything in life that's worth doing comes with a price tag, but the philosophy is this is done with joy, and it's worth it. But it's, you know, within that, perhaps to begin to talk with our children, as Rabbi Weinrib talked before, about a sense of spirituality and a personal relationship with God, and really perhaps the idea of bitachon and what that means to have trust and faith in God and doing what is the right thing, even though it's kind of scary, and to have a sense of trust that God will take care.
I would say, too, in depends where you live and what conditions you are. In Brooklyn, you got to be careful. But but seriously, there may be places where the anti-Semitism is so real and so really dangerous that you want to tell your kids not to wear the Jewish star or even not to wear the yarmulke or whatever to avoid real possible physical harm. I don't mean to cringe and to hide, etc., but sometimes you've got to be wise and practical as well. The ultimate answer, of course, is to the degree that we can instill in our kids and in ourselves a sense of Jewish pride, that's how we deal with anti-Semitism. The Jews have learned already the real way to deal with anti-Semitism is not by newspapers and ads and educational programs, but by being more Jewish. It's a paradox. But the more Jewish we are, the more successful we are in our battles with anti-Semitism. A question for Dr. Loeb from the lecture, his lecture. I'm curious about the line between apologizing to children and seeking their forgiveness. And a note, for the parent who asked about sincere apologies, We always expect our children to make their apologies, quote, I'm sorry that I, dot, dot, dot. So they articulate what they are apologizing for. That's obviously for Dr. Loeb.
I'm not sure if I understand the question, but I'm curious about the line between apologizing to children and seeking their forgiveness. The idea that I was talking about was the sense of that when we cross the line, our children need to know that they live in a safe home. And because parents aren't perfect, there are going to be times that we're going to blow it. Within the context of really of the theme of the night that I've heard from many speakers, which is modeling, I said that it's powerful in a home to be able to say that in this family, when we've done something hurtful, we say we're sorry, whether that's from spouse to spouse or from parent to children. And that includes parent to children. That would include seeking their forgiveness, too. I'm not sure if there's a negative connotation with that, which means to say the apology in a way that the child knows that I'm really sorry, that it's not just something that I'm saying.
I just want to say something. Frank gave himself the liberty of a commercial for the Orthodox Union, and I can certainly take that liberty. We've had these parenting conferences now, and they're really all coordinated by Frank. We've had them really across the country. We've had several in Chicago and Los Angeles and Florida and many, many in the New York area. We very, very much appreciate your feedback and input, and every conference takes into account the evaluations of all previous conferences so that hopefully we're constantly improving. So please do remember to fill out your evaluation forms, etc. But something you might consider, too, is suggesting other kinds of programs besides parenting and marriage enrichment. One initiative that was just announced, really we just gave a press release a couple of days ago, is an initiative to deal with the problems of substance abuse and other delinquent behaviors in our midst, with children mainly, but with adults who model some of this behavior. We had a meeting in the office, our office is about in New York, about 2 weeks ago, where we had about 65 or 70 rabbis from across the greater New York area and educators, principals, et cetera, from across the New York area to discuss this problem. We are taking the lead in this initiative of trying to develop a comprehensive program, which we will pilot in a community in the New York area, but then, as we did with the parenting conference, go national or international to deal with these issues. And it's interesting that when we, the staff, brought this program and the plan and the dream, the vision, to the board says, well, we have a place to start. And the board, the lay board, passed a statement, which we'll be publicizing soon once we get the wording right, to take on something which some of you may never have heard of, thankfully, and some of you know all too well about, and that's the phenomenon in certain synagogues of the Kiddush Club, where people, men, adults usually, leave the prayer service during the Haftorah, when the words of the prophets are being read, the words which, pardon the pun, these people would profit from, and retire to some side room or off the premises and engage in imbibing several samples of the finest single malts, and often return to the synagogue, at best smelling rather foul, but at worst tipsy or worse. And we feel, first of all, this is an intolerable, blasphemous desecration of the synagogue and synagogue prayer. But in terms of substance abuse, it is modeling substance abuse, alcohol abuse for our children. And I will tell you that, at least in the community where I spent so many years in Baltimore, every single case of alcohol addiction in the Orthodox Jewish community, every single one, you asked the child, where did he learn to drink? And he said, in the synagogue. Or at the Bar Mitzvah, or the Sheva Brachas, or the Shalom Azach, or whatever. That's where kids, our kids at least, learn to drink. And whether you believe me or not, and this is a dispute among social scientists about this, but I firmly believe that alcohol abuse is the first step toward abuse of other substances. So this is not the whole program, but we are encouraging synagogues across the Orthodox world to develop, each synagogue in its own way, a plan that will eliminate this intolerable practice of Kiddush clubs. But not the Kiddush club issue. It's the issue of substance abuse across our society that we're taking on. But I give another question or two, and then we'll have to close. This question asks, what do you do if you have a very demanding child or a child who requires a lot of attention, i.e. learning disabled, ADD, etc., and it takes away time, patience, attention from the other siblings? takes away from the parental needs, from at the parental needs of the other siblings, can fall through the cracks. A very common tale, but true. And does anyone want to address it?
As the member of the panel with the worst case of ADD, it's you didn't have to agree so quickly, Jerry. You know, as I mentioned, I think in my group, one of the myths of parenting is that all children are equally easy to raise, and it's just not true. There are some children that are far more demanding, and some children who manage to do very well with a minimal amount of parenting. That's a reality of life. It is true that sometimes the siblings will suffer in silence. They resent it. They resent the extra attention. They resent that sibling. However, cognizant of the demands on the parents and perhaps the anguish of the parents for having a child like this, they hold it inside, and then sometimes it can come out later. Sometimes it can be expressed in adulthood or at some later point, or sometimes even, you know, there's a term in the literature sometimes called a missed adolescence, which is adults who feel they missed out on the opportunity to engage in normal adolescent rebellion and tries to do so as adults. It does take, you cannot evenly distribute yourself. And it will be true that throughout childhood or even at certain periods in childhood, that some of the children may demand more of you than the other children do. You do need to take aside some time to give this recognition, to acknowledge this, to let the other children know that this is no reflection how you feel about them, and sometimes even a matter of explaining to the siblings that this child, and it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, but maybe necessary, that this child has certain situations, conditions, etc., that require more, and this is maybe something that we all have to engage in, that in a way you can sometimes mobilize the siblings to participate in helping their sibling by either a certain willingness to do with less or to somehow participate in the help or the need that the child has to have. But also taking aside sometimes saying, listen, we're going to have a special treat, we're going to have a special day together because I understand the sacrifices that you're making. The recognition alone, I think, does it.
I always have to add what Mom says. I just want to say that it doesn't just in Africa take a village to raise a child. And one of the things I think that is incumbent upon us as a community is to recognize that Jewish parenting is a communal event, that we celebrate our simchas together, we also cry at our levayas, at our funerals together, and that when parenting gets tough, we need to turn to the people next to us, our neighbors, our friends, our rebbeim, our shuls, our schools, and look for support. In our neighborhood, they have started a shadow program where older children give respite to special needs families Shabbos afternoon by going and playing with their children. It is a wonderful, wonderful experience, not just for the families who need it. I can say as the mother of a child who goes as a shadow to help another little boy, that it has been a life-changing experience for him. And in that way, I think we have to look more and more towards other resources when families are feeling at their wits' end to provide for all their own needs.
Yeah, I just want to say, backing up Rona's point, we have a program within the OU, we have a department called NJCD, National Jewish Council for Disabilities. And the most famous or largest piece of that division is Yachad. And Yachad is a program that we have to provide a Jewish environment for people, not just young people, who are developmentally disabled. We have a program every summer called Yad B'Yad. Yad B'Yad, we take 30 handicapped children, and we have 30 volunteers, normal children, non-handicapped children, who volunteer to spend several weeks on a bus ride up and down the East Coast or up and down the West Coast or wherever they choose to go. And the kids are matched one-to-one. And one of the highlights of my past 3 years with the OU is after every summer, there's an event where all the non-handicapped helpers or shadows or whatever who are on the trip come, they go to the dinkiest, greasiest, sloppiest deli in Manhattan, and which is where they like to go, and have this celebration and reunion. I went there the first year, 3 years ago, post-summer, and I was very impressed with these youngsters. And I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to visit this program before the 3 weeks or 6 weeks and see these kids who are high school seniors, college freshmen, non-handicapped, meet them, and then visit them again in the post-summer reunion. So I want to see the before and after effects on them. It's amazing. These kids who are spending their summers helping severely disabled kids one-on-one, helping them get dressed, helping them with their toilet needs, et cetera, et cetera. Those 2 months are transformative. These kids come back literally different kids, a different type of responsibility, talk to their parents, they have different kids back home, they have different siblings. Helping another person is a tremendously transformative experience. And one can use that as a technique, not manipulatively, but honestly, in achieving some kinds of change in kids.
We're going to finish this conference 15 minutes early, which means it's 45 minutes earlier Jewish time. And set your clock. I'm going to take 150 seconds of your time just to close. This conference pretty much had everything, even lollipops. It was amazing. They were even giving out lollipops. It was great to see parents eating lollipops during this time period. It meant showed people were comfortable, and that's tremendous. I want to welcome you here to the Village Shul Eishet Torah Learning Center. One of the unique phenomenons in our building, you might have noticed, is a mission statement. And on that mission statement, the last part of it is that we're a community that's not narcissistic, we're not self-absorbed, at least we're striving not to be. And the last part of our mission statement is to effect positive change in the Jewish community, not only here in Toronto, but beyond. And that's why we're very proud that one of our projects is the Jewish Family Institute. And I really feel that tonight we did effect positive change. I know I'm going home different, and I'm sure all of you are going home just a little bit more focused on becoming, on being, and continuing to be great parents. And in having that sense of feeling great about tonight, I want to specifically thank, first of all, the OU for developing this tremendous, tremendous program. And now, I was walking around in different programs in Rabbi Weinrib's talk, and there was a common denominator besides the chachma, the tremendous wisdom that they imparted, the secular and Jewish knowledge coming together. It was the sense of non-judgmentalism, of true caring and love, which they imparted, every single speaker imparted. And I think that was part of what made this night so terrific and so magical. And especially yashar koach to Jane Ilana Kelman for bringing the program into town and bringing it to our attention, and it was a pleasure partnering with you guys in making it happen. Last point is the OU obviously is a national, international organization. You can continue with them on the .com, on that thing, I think they call it the net, something net. You continue with that, but obviously Torah in Motion is in Toronto, and the Jewish Family Institute is in Toronto, and the Village Shul and Eishet Torah is in Toronto. So please avail yourselves of the opportunity. There's literature here for Torah in Motion, and there's obviously literature here for the Jewish Family Institute and the Village Shul. In your loot bag, you'll also notice a speakers bureau that the Jewish Family Institute has. You can bring those speakers into your own home, and you can follow up with someone who I think gets a very special yashar koach, which we'll end off with. I want to give a very special thank you to Bronwyn Shepherd for everything that she does. So I believe I made it within 180 seconds. We're letting you out 45 minutes early Jewish time. Have a great night. Kol Tov. Take care.